Accession number 9146, rule number 1.
Brigadier Wedderburn Maxwell, take one. Could I ask you something first of all, Brigadier, about your childhood? Whereabouts were you brought up?
Well, I was born down near Maidstone. My mother's family came from a place called Hartlip, and my father met her before marriage. My father was he'd finished his Indian service and retired, and he came home and he met my mother at a house party in Scotland, a shooting party. They got engaged, and then they got married, and he went and lived down near her home in Hartlip in Kent for over 2 or 3 years. I was born there. My elder sister was born first, then myself, down at Hartlip. And then we moved up to Scotland because my grandfather was getting old, and my father had to be ready to take over the property from him. And we went up to very near Glenlair in Cuckoobershire. There he took over the shooting and running the estate, which is about 2,500 acres. A very nice little mixed shoot with half a dozen farms. It didn't pay its way because every penny you got in rent, you spent maintaining the farms. And one found that the farmers wouldn't lift a finger to do anything themselves, mending the kitchen floor or anything, because it was in the lease that the owner, the laird, as they called him, had to do the job. Since then, it's all changed, and the farmers are all working very hard on their properties because I had to sell it after the war. One couldn't afford it any longer. But as a small boy, we were brought up very wild in the country. I had another sister came a year after me, and then two brothers in succession. And so there were five of us, and we ran absolutely wild. When anybody came over the bridge into the drive up towards the house, we used to bolt for it and get down in the farm buildings or bury ourselves in a hay shed so we wouldn't hear when we were being called. And we were absolute savages.
Where did you go to school?
I went to school at the age of 10, a small school called Limehouse, Wetherill, near Carlisle. And I had a very undistinguished career there. I did finish up head boy and so on, but there were only about 35 to 40 of us. And I enjoyed it. I tried to get a scholarship for Charterhouse, where I had three uncles, and my father wasn't a rich man by any means. And I failed to get a scholarship, but I managed to go to Charterhouse all the same. And after 3 years there, my next brother joined me from the same preparatory school, and he did much better. He got the bottom scholarship at Charterhouse. He tried first of all for some B's and up in Northumberland, and got the top scholarship. And so then my parents said, "Well, have a crack at the Charterhouse," which he did, and got the bottom scholarship. We were very good friends, the whole five of us, but we kept drifting into different little power units. I'd be with my big brother against my father, possibly, not in anger, but in normal behavior. And sometimes I'd be with my little brother against the rest of them. You never knew where you were going to be. But what we did with a tremendous amount of sporting life, shooting. And when the snow came down, we loved it because we used to go out all over this sizable estate chasing hares in the tracks in the snow. But at the age of 8, I think I've killed my first rabbit. I was with the gamekeeper. And fished a lot. There were two or three little locks we used to get trout off. And, catapults, of course, we used. Then in the summer, my father used to lease the place for the shooting for 2 to 3 months to people, the rich men, as we call them, from Manchester and some from London. Each year, we leased the place so that they could go abroad for the waters. My father had bad gout and rheumatism, and we used to go to the seaside with under dear old nanny, little Mrs. Croft, about the height of that mantelpiece, who handled the five of us with the most tremendous ability. And we all adored her, I suppose, more or less as much as one's mother, who we also loved very dearly. But this dear old nanny, she was everything to us. And we used to go to the local, to Toon in Ayrshire, or to Silloth in Cumberland, or somewhere near the home. And that went on, one just grew up doing that. I went to Charterhouse, I say, when I was 13, in 1908. Yes, 1908, and did a very undistinguished career there, but I enjoyed it, and I even towards the end of my time, I enjoyed going back at the end of the holidays. The beginning of my time at Charterhouse, I was a bit on the weepy side, or certainly at my prep school. I used to hate going away from home. It was more nostalgia, I think, than anything else.
Was there much talk about the army in your household? Your father...
Well, my father had been a soldier in India for 20, 25 years. His father had been what they call the collector, which is a very senior appointment in the Indian Civil Service. So India was right in our veins. When people write and say it nowadays, how we milked India and we ill-treated them and exploited them, I always take up the Khaisals. We took peace to India, stopped the warring tribes, we took prosperity, and although they were regarded as an inferior community, the Sahablog, as we were called, were very much respected and completely trusted. One thing, a small item which I like rubbing in, is that whenever there was a big cholera outbreak in my grandfather's province, I think it was Madras, my father used to get leave from his regiment to go and work in the cholera camp to help his father out and to help the coloured, the brown men. Well, that wasn't the act of a man exploiting anybody. He always wanted to be a doctor, and my grandfather said, no, a doctor isn't a job for a gentleman. He wanted me to go into business. But I was always very fond of soldiering type of life, and joined the Boy Scouts as soon as they came out. And when I went to Charterhouse, I joined the Rifle Corps. And with my, I suppose even then, rather independent spirit, I managed to get into the Scouts, so that one had slightly different job in the Corps to those who marched down the road in fours.
When did you think of going to Sandhurst? Was this automatic that you would go there?
Well, I liked my life in the Corps, and my father has always said no good going into the army, you won't get anywhere. It's not the life. Well, there's no future for you unless you go into the Royal Engineers, the sappers. There's always a job after you've left, when you've retired at the age of 40, 45, there's always a job in business because people want engineers and you're safe there. So I said, right, I'll have a go for Woolwich, through which you had to go for a year and a half or 2 years, it varied, to get your commission. And I got into Woolwich quite fairly high up, kind of 50 out of 120 or something like that. There's nothing to boast about. But I got in, and then I found that I was just not mentally capable of the higher, getting into the higher grade, and I stayed on naturally, it was my part of my education. I stayed on at Woolwich, and determined to get into the Royal Artillery, or the Royal Field Artillery, as it was in those days. And so I did that my 3 years, my 3 terms there. started off as what they called a snooker, which meant you fairly had it put across you by the senior terms. Tremendously strict discipline and very good for us all. It is a very high standard, not only, as I say, at the shop itself with the officers, but with the cadets themselves, and they just they ran most of the discipline, really, what was done and what wasn't done. But I enjoyed it. It was very hard work. You felt frightfully fit, and you played a lot of games. I only played tennis and soccer. I sometimes played for the shop at soccer, but only on rare occasions. I wasn't good enough to be above the second 11. And then in 1914, I don't think there was much more to say about it. Oh, so there was one thing. Some very pleasant people took the house next door to us down the river, a rather smaller estate, but the same type of living, called Glendinning. And I suddenly found myself frightfully interested at the age of 18 or 19 in the younger daughter, who was an absolute sweetie, called Ruth. And I very much fell for her, and we were always on our bikes going down there to play tennis on their court, or getting them to come up to Glenlair and play on ours. But that was a sweet little romance, the first of them. I remember when we went to France, I sent a telegram saying, off at last, Chestnut and Bay, my two chargers. I had a very nice little chestnut horse and a very rather wild bay.
Yes, I must ask you now about the outbreak of war. What was your situation when war was declared? You know, were you
Yes, well, we'd gone off on holiday after three terms. We went off holiday early in July, and we moved out from Glenlair to make room for the rich tenants. Went to a place called Moffat, about 20 or 30 miles away. And so my elder sister and I were up there getting the house ready when suddenly the war exploded. I suppose most people know, a lot of people knew it was going to come, but we didn't. And we didn't look as far ahead as that. We were thinking about the sport and what was going to happen in our holidays. And suddenly it blew up, and all us cadets who hadn't got our commissions were called back straight back to Woolwich. But being in Scotland, one was a day late. The other Scots cadets too, we were all about a dozen of us, on the late side, so that the chance of getting into the Royal Field Artillery was not good. The first pick would have gone already with the Field Artillery, which left most of the vacancies required in the Garrison Artillery. Now the Garrison Artillery garrisoned places like Malta and Gibraltar and parts of India and in the canals, Egypt. And not the sort of life I hoped to go to. There were garrison stations all over Ireland and so on. And I wanted to go into the mounted unit with the Royal Field Artillery. And the Field Artillery's job was always to support infantry, and or sometimes cavalry. But you never knew what you were going to be called on to do. And you had horses, and you were always riding. And I was determined to get there. And when I got back to London, to Woolwich, I saw the adjutant of Woolwich, who was a very nice fellow, very strict, and very senior to me as a boy of 19, 20. And he said, "Well, you'll be for garrison artillery." So I begged him to let me go, to have me posted to field artillery. He said, "Well, all right, you can. Right, all right, you put you into field artillery," which is why I got in there.
And you would have then got your commission right away?
As we arrived in London, I was getting my commission actually. That was the day I got to Woolwich, when I saw Asser, the adjutant of Woolwich, at the shop. Yes, well, you do it very, very pleasantly. At the shop, we used to get weekends off. And I had a very good friend, Pug Payne, from Charterhouse, who was a brilliant athlete, and we shared a room together. And we had several entertaining escapades. I used to have to answer for him on roll call when they were staying late in London, extending their leave. I was rather well behaved on the whole. And then one morning, I got a chit from Pug Payne from the shop hospital, saying, dear Widders, get me the strongest appearance you can find anywhere. I'm here to avoid an exam due to sickness, and so nothing was ever the matter with me. But so far I've been trying to produce some evidence, but have failed miserably. Go down the town and get this appearance. So I put on my red hat, blue and red hat, got on my bike and pedalled down in the break in the morning, came back with a packet of pills, and said, here you are, Pug, and the most you mistake is two. He said, that's all right, and took six. And the charm worked, and he was excused to sitting for this exam. He was a very naughty boy, but I loved him very much, and he I saw a lot later on in life.
What happened to you when you received your commission?
Nothing much. We were just told to go and get yourself rigged up with uniform, bedding, all this certain, a long list of things you had to provide. And I was given a cheque for 50 quid. And my father was. And I spent it and he got it back from the army.
Was that quite straightforward, getting your kit together?
Absolutely, yes.
And where would you have been sent then for... You know, what was the unit you were attached to,
well,
the battery?
Well, having got my commission, I was sent off back to Scotland to wind up my very minor affairs, if there were any. And then I suddenly got an order to report to the 45th Brigade, Royal Field Artillery, at Leeds.
And would that have been the 5th Battery?
5th Battery, yes.
It
was the 5th Battery. It had three batteries, the 1st, 3rd and the 5th.
What would the strength of that battery have been?
The battery was about 200 men and about 200 horses.
And was
six
that
guns.
Yes. Was it up to full strength when you actually joined it at Leeds?
Well, there was practically nobody there at all. They'd all gone to in the mobilisation of the first four divisions, which is the original intention of the British Expeditionary Force, the BEF. They had the reservists to make up their strength, and they took serving soldiers from people like our 45th Brigade who were not mobilising.
Was it quickly brought up to strength?
What?
Would you say it was soon brought up to strength, that battery? Did it take
long? Yes, I had come to that. Yes, while we were at Leeds, we filled up considerably with men and horses. They came in off the plough and out of the van and from all over the country. It was wonderfully laid on. It was a very good mobilisation indeed. That book will show you what happened in the Second War, which is disgraceful. But it was a very high-class thing. And then as we got too strong for the barracks, meant to hold one battery, two of us, two batteries, the 3rd and the 5th, mine, went on to Sheffield. And there we again continued filling ourselves up with reservists and people from all over the place, like the riding establishments at Woolwich and people who were no longer required. And when we got too many personnel for Leeds, the 1st battery, the 5th battery, with me, went on to Norwich. I had found, on joining, my major, no other officers. He was a delightful old gentleman, the absolute eyeglass, monocle, and the troops adored him.
What was his name?
Thackeray. He was a descendant, C.B. Thackeray. He was a shyish man, and took me a long while to feel at ease with him. Of course, I was an absolute little boy, and I didn't know what the hell was happening anyhow. When I joined the brigade first, the first night in mess, the adjutant, who was one of my lifelong friends, called Arthur Main, and a very, very great, fine soldier. He was one of the real leaders of soldiering in the Royal Regiment, Arthur Main. He came and sat at our end of the table, with three or four of us, for mass the first night, which is unheard of. Normally, a young chap joining a unit, straight from nowhere, he was ignored. He sat alone at the bottom of the table for 6 weeks, and people didn't really talk to him or anything. But with the war on, Arthur he killed all that and treated one like a fellow soldier and all for help. He said, "Oh yes, well, you got all your kit here." I said, "Well, no, sir." He said, "Well, you silly young sod, or silly little sod, what do you think you're going to sleep in? You come along to my room, I'll give you something." And so he found me in my bedding till I had bought some for myself, and so on. And then, as I say, the battery left the brigade headquarters and went on up to Norwich. And Norwich, we had a wonderful time there. We took over the Coleman's Mustard Works sports ground, took from billeted there. And it was a lovely exercise field with lots and lots of fences. We took our charges up and trained them for jumping and really enjoyed ourselves and worked very hard. Then the Kitchener raised his arm. He put the call out, "King and country need you." And we found ourselves absolutely inundated. We had 1,000 men, the cream of the country, came rolling in, as they joined up, in their old clothes, a ragged lot, but of magnificent men, and we'd also filled up the battery by then, about 200. And so at the age of just over 20, I found myself commanding a section, that's two guns, in the 6-gun battery, the 5th battery. And 1,000 men, Kitchener's army, there was 1,000 men of Kitchener's army, divided into 3 batteries, of which one was mine. There was no equipment, no weapons, no anything, but they were there, and we started drilling them and getting to know them and organizing them and pulling out the good ones to make NCOs and all that sort of thing. It was tremendous fun and really hard work.
What was the standard of these men, this first flood that came through? Were they very high standard?
Yes, they were. They weren't what called gentlefolk, the gentry, a lot of them, but a lot of them were. And there were shop people, clerks out of offices, servants from big houses, butlers, all that sort of thing.
You referred to them as the cream, which...
Oh yes, they were the cream of the country, because they rushed up to help as soon as the call went out. They absolutely poured in.
How soon were you able to kit them out with uniform?
Well, this quartermaster sergeant came to the major one day at Norwich and said, "We must have some clothing for these men, sir, and there's no uniform available. What's to happen?" So Tim, with barely a thought, said, "Go down the town, buy 1,000 blue serge suits of various sizes, get 2,000 pairs of boots and socks, and 2,000 shirts." And of course the bloke said, "Right, sir, but who do I say pays for this?" He said, "I'll sign for it, and there's so much there that when you do a thing on a big enough scale, you can't get run for it. The government will pay all right." And so they did that. And we had them rigged out in Bolette, and looking very smart, very keen lot.
So they would have worn these blue serge suits before their uniforms came.
Oh yes, 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 that's how they paraded. That was their uniform till the khaki uniforms were forthcoming and available from the mobilisation stores and everything else.
So would any of those men have gone overseas wearing those suits?
No, oh no, no question about that.
They would have been kitted out before they...
Oh
left.
Yes, oh yes. You had to go. In those days, you were a full-blown soldier. Well, we had a great time at Norwich, and our regular soldiers, as ever, went in for sport and boxing. And one day, one of my signalers turned up with a little kitten with a lovely white face, and white breast to it, and this was, we dubbed it, we called it Dublin, and that cat went overseas with us and stayed with the guns the whole war, with the battery the whole war, with the guns right up to the Battle of the Somme, when we said it was too dangerous for Dublin, and we didn't let him go up to the guns. We were in three lots, you see, the observation party, directing fire and keeping in touch with the infantry. Then there's the battery itself with the six guns, sometimes cut down to four and two sent somewhere else. And finally there was the horse lines, 2 or 3 miles behind, where all the horses had to live. You couldn't keep them up all around your guns. And they lived in factories and places like that. So there were the three lots, the observers, the firing batteries, and the horse lines, and the quartermasters on the stores, and all that sort of thing.
Were there many other animals at the front, Drew, or would Dublin have been an exception?
Well, I think Dublin must have been almost unique. From time to time you picked up the odd cow, if you found one wandering about after the villages had all fled, and you found chickens and things. But I don't remember any other pets. When the war was over, our vet, I found in this new unit, the brigade, as it was called in those days, of three batteries, the brigade had a veterinary officer and a medical officer and a padre. The veterinary officer came from County Cork, Mickey O'Sullivan, and he was an absolute winner, but a savage Roman Catholic. And the doctor came from Ulster. And the two loathed each other. Absolutely, they could not take each other, the North Ireland and the South, even in those days. Pretty extraordinary.
And how did the padre fit in? Did he?
He had a free run. I think he was more or less with the divisional artillery and used to wander around and see to people's welfare and had a very close eye on what was happening, a good padre. I had later on in the Second War, I had a very good padre who kept one wise of what was happening.